Oh, I was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. The Russian Air Force Tuesday launched a major operation in Syria's Idlib and Homs provinces. In Washington, the State Department blasted Moscow for the new attacks.
We strongly condemn the resumption of airstrikes in Syria by the Russians as well as the Syrian regime. The most recent reported attacks are on 5 hospitals and 1 mobile clinic in Syria. We believe it's a violation of international law. Is that despite Russian claims that it halted airstrikes in the past month, Russia allowed no aid or food into East Aleppo. It let Eastern Aleppo residents starve while seeking praise from the international community for halting indiscriminate strikes.
Separately, Tuesday, Syrian news reports said government aircraft bombed terrorist strongholds in Eastern Aleppo, a territory populated by as many as 300,000 civilians and rebel forces seeking to topple the government of President Bashar al-Assad. United Nations agencies warn food shortages in Syria are growing. We have a report from Lisa Schlein.
The UN agencies blamed the deteriorating food situation in Syria on widespread insecurity and unfavorable weather conditions in parts of the country. Those factors, they say, are preventing farmers from accessing their land and making it difficult for them to earn a living. They warn rising prices and a lack of fertilizer and seeds may force many farmers to abandon their land unless they receive immediate help. Lisa Schlein, Geneva.
President Obama was in Greece Tuesday, assuring America's European allies that the U.S. will retain its commitment to NATO under the presidency of Donald Trump. On his last foreign trip, the president said, quoting now, "NATO provides significantly continued even as we see a transition of government in the United States." This is VOA News. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump and Vice President-elect Mike Pence met Tuesday in New York to discuss key appointments in their new government. The two have more than 4,000 jobs to fill in the U.S. government as they prepare to assume power January 20th. But their immediate focus is on filling the top diplomatic posts and that of the Defense Secretary, Attorney General, and Homeland Security Chief. So far, Trump's choice as a chief strategist is generating the most pushback from civil rights observers, such as Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center.
We are very seriously concerned that Donald Trump has named Stephen Bannon to the senior advisor position in the White House. It's a disaster. In effect, what President-elect Trump is doing is inviting white nationalism directly into the People's House in Washington, D.C.
Nearly 1,000 high school students from Washington, D.C. and the surrounding areas walked out of their schools and marched across the city Tuesday in protest of President-elect Donald Trump. Activist groups are looking ahead to march on the day after Inauguration Day on January 20th, with many people on Facebook indicating their intent to fly to Washington to take part. The election of Donald Trump is casting a cloud over the conference of the U.N. Framework Convention on Climate Change. President-elect Trump, during the recent campaign, vowed to rip up the Paris Agreement on climate change. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says the new president will have to face reality.
We have seen many such campaign rhetorics in not only in the United States, in many parts of the world. But as President Obama said in his press conference yesterday, he may have to understand the reality.
Trump's election is also expected to overshadow the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting scheduled for later in the week. Many leaders are concerned about Trump's opposition to the U.S.-led Trans-Pacific Partnership, which still has not been approved by the U.S. Congress. An Egyptian court has thrown out death sentence against former President Mohamed Morsi and ordered a retrial on charges connected to a prison break during the 2011 uprising. The Court of Cassations also said Tuesday 5 other co-defendants will also get new trials. Morsi became Egypt's first democratically elected president in 2012, but he lasted only a year in office before protesters held mass rallies accusing him of monopolizing power and failing to fix Egypt's economy. I'm Michael Brown in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. DRC President Joseph Kabila Tuesday addressed the country's parliament.
DRC President Joseph Kabila was cheered to the platform to address the National Assembly and Senate. Kabila used a rare public address to defend an October 18th agreement between his political alliance and an opposition faction.
That's viewers William Klaus in Kinshasa. A Liberian opposition presidential candidate congratulates U.S. President-elect Donald Trump. Kenya may miss the deadline to close the Dadaab refugee camp. Egypt's top appeals court quashed his death sentence for former President Mohamed Morsi. And former Gabonese presidential candidate Jean Ping is in Washington, D.C.
Well, I'm here to try to promote the values which we share with you. I am not here to ask for money. I'm not here to ask for troops or armament.
That's former Gabonese presidential candidate Jean Ping. The UN Refugee Agency distributes items to thousands of displaced people in South Sudan. And a new report says internet freedom continues to decline worldwide. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In a rare public appearance, Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila addressed Parliament on Tuesday, one day after his government resigned in accordance with a deal that keeps him in office until elections scheduled for 2018. But much of the opposition continues to call for Kabila to step down. William Klaus has the latest from Kinshasa.
DRC President Joseph Kabila was cheered to the platform to address the National Assembly and Senate. His 45-minute speech was punctuated by frequent applause. Kabila used a rare public address to defend an October 18th agreement between his political alliance and an opposition faction. The deal permits the president to remain in power beyond December 19th, the final day of his second and under the current constitution final term, until the next election, which has been provisionally scheduled for April 2018. Kabila's prime minister resigned on Monday, and the DRC is awaiting the formation of a new government of national unity to lead the country towards the election. A larger opposition group known as the Rassemblement boycotted the deal and has demanded that the president step down on December 19th. During the speech, Kabila urged the Rassemblement to sign the agreement, saying it was his most ardent wish. Kabila aimed a warning at the opposition coalition, saying that as the guarantor of Congolese institutions, he cannot allow the country to be taken hostage by a fringe of the political class. Kabila said he would shortly appoint a new prime minister to lead the DRC to elections. The president indirectly addressed the widespread concerns that he plans to change the constitution to allow him to stand for a third term. Kabila said the constitution will be respected in all its dispositions. But for many Congolese, this statement is not enough. VOA spoke with the president of the African Association for the Defense of Human Rights, Jean-Claude Katende. The question that needs to be answered, Katende said, is whether the speech responded to the preoccupations of the Congolese people. Katende says that the Congolese people think Kabila should have taken the opportunity to announce that he will leave power on December 19th. Katende described the speech as totally disconnected from the aspirations of the Congolese population. According to Katende, Kabila's promise to respect the constitution does not rule out the possibility of him seeking to modify the constitution. We remain very worried about the political future of President Kabila, Katende said. Kabila has led Congo since succeeding his father Laurent Kabila in 2001, initially as an unelected head of state and since 2006 as the elected president. William Klaus for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Gabonese opposition leader and former presidential candidate Jean Ping is in Washington, D.C. Mr. Ping contested the August 27 Gabonese election against President Ali Bongo. He has challenged the results of the vote. In this interview with VOA's French 2 Africa service, Mr. Ping says he is in the United States to ask for the reaffirmation of what he called our shared values, democracy, rule of law, human rights, and the preservation of peace and security.
Well, I'm here to try to promote the values which we share with you. I'm not here to ask for money. I'm not here to ask for troops or armament. We are here to say that we should reaffirm our shared values, value of democracy, value of rule of state, value of human rights, value of preserving peace and security. We are here for that. And what we would like to see is that we recognize all these values, we share them together, and the truth should be said.
So you have been also in Bruxelles, in Paris, in Europe, and you're waiting for the report of the European Union about the election in Gabon. What are you waiting exactly from this report?
Well, we have asked the European Union, also NDI, and several others, observers, to come and observe the election in Gabon. It is not to observe and not saying the truth. So the report of the European Union is going to be published in a few days, between now and 2 weeks. So they will say that they will tell the truth to the population of Gabon, also to the international community. We are expecting that as a very strong moment.
Do you feel a big frustration about the fact that during the election, the international community didn't say a lot about it and they didn't recognize what happened to you?
It's very difficult for me. I am a diplomat, and it's very difficult for me to criticize partners while we are calling them to help the population of Gabon. The population of Gabon is asking the international community to help a people in danger. If there is no assistance to people in danger, it might be regrettable for us, but it might be regrettable also for the rest of the world.
So you are here just after the election, the American election, and Donald Trump was elected president. So what do you think about that, about this kind of democracy in the USA, if you compare to Gabon?
Well, first of all, that's what is admirable here in America, is that the elections are proclaiming the winner, and it is accepted. In spite of some frustration, it is accepted. So what happened here, it is something which we hope that Gabon will happen also in Gabon, that the winner is proclaimed winner, you know. We are here also to celebrate the American democracy.
The voice of America is going through the 75th anniversary. What would you say to the people who are working at the Voice of America?
Well, first of all, happy birthday to you. Secondly, the Voice of America is the voice of America, the most powerful country in the world. So this should be understood that the Voice of America is listened all over the world. There is another dimension, is that the Voice of America did not speak and publish and broadcast only in English. They broadcast in French. They broadcast in several other languages. But they broadcast also in African national languages, such as Swahili, such as Bambara, in many other languages, which means that those people, some of them are illiterate, they follow the radio and they follow the Voice of America in their own native languages.
That's Gabonese opposition leader and former presidential candidate Jean Ping. He spoke to viewers French to Africa service in our Washington studio. Today is Wednesday, November 16th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Egypt's top appeals court has quashed a death sentence against former Islamist President Mohamed Morsi, along with sentences against five other top Muslim Brotherhood leaders. Morsi was ousted by the military in June 2013 following popular protest against his rule. He will still have to serve lengthy sentences in separate cases, Edward Urania reports from Cairo.
Mohamed Mursal Ayat, Mohamed Ibrahim Al-Biltegi.
Egypt's Court of Cassation overturned a June 2015 death sentence against former President Mohamed Morsi in a case relating to his breaking out of prison during the country's January 2011 revolution against longtime Egyptian leader Hosni Mubarak. Five of Morsi's associates also had their sentences reduced in the case. Morsi will continue to serve 20 to 40-year sentences in three cases. The most serious involves transmitting secret government documents to the Arab Gulf state of Qatar. Qatar was an ally and supporter of the former president and the Muslim Brotherhood group. Abdulmunam Abdulmaksud, a lawyer for the now outlawed group, told the Reuters news agency that he believes the appeals court acted in a fair and impartial manner. The ruling, he insists, was expected because the original conviction was flawed. Veteran Egyptian editor and publisher Hisham Qasim tells VOA that he does not believe the ruling has any political implications and that the appeals court is not generally subject to political manipulation.
The Cassation Court is known for its independence, the government's ability, the different regimes from Mubarak to Morsi to Sisi now, their ability to manipulate these high-level courts is very limited. And they basically look at if due process has been observed, and if not, then they order a retrial.
Qasim points out that Morsi, while president, antagonized Egypt's judiciary, attempting to force many judges to resign in a bid to Islamicize the country's courts. Rulings involving mass death sentences that were made after Morsi's ouster were often the result of ill feelings by judges against the Muslim Brotherhood. Some behind-the-scenes attempts to reduce tensions with the Muslim Brotherhood are underway, Qasim thinks, but he doesn't believe that Tuesday's court ruling is part of that effort.
There happens to be the beginnings, the very shy beginnings of a political reconciliation, but I don't think it's related to what we're seeing from the courts.
In a separate case, the court ordered the release of two sons of former President Hosni Mubarak, Alaa and Gamal. Both men were being held over alleged financial improprieties dealing with government property. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A Liberian opposition leader and candidate in next year's presidential election has sent a message of congratulations to U.S. President-elect Donald Trump. Charles Brumskin of the Liberty Party says he is confident that under Mr. Trump's leadership, the United States will continue to play its role as the leader of the free world. Last week, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf said she was saddened by the fact that U.S. voters had not elected a woman president. In an interview reportedly with the BBC, Mrs. Sirleaf expressed concern about what President-elect Donald Trump's policy towards Africa would be like. But Brumskin says while Liberia and the rest of Africa should be concerned, they should give Mr. Trump a chance to first craft his Africa policy.
The American voters have spoken in keeping with a long democratic tradition, and we believe our role is simply to congratulate the winner and the American people. So that's what we have done. We wish President-elect Trump and the people of the United States well.
As you know, Liberia has had long relations with the United States. Liberia is going to election also next year. What type of relationship would you like Liberia should have with the new administration?
Well, like we said in our congratulatory message, we will work continuously along with our own government of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to ensure that the historic relationship that have existed over the years between Liberia and the United States only grow to the benefit of our two peoples.
You mentioned President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. She said, I think, in an interview with the BBC that she was saddened by the fact that U.S. voters have not elected a woman president. Of course, the president herself is the first female elected president in Africa. Is she also concerned about what President-elect Trump's policy towards Africa would be? What do you make of the fact that she's saddened Americans did not elect a woman president?
Well, I would believe that President Sirleaf spoke in her own behalf personally, and in that respect, not necessarily on behalf of the people of Liberia, because our role is not to pass judgment on the results of the elections of the United States of America. But like I said, to respect the fact that the democratic process has taken place, the people have spoken, and we congratulate them, and we look forward to having the same democratic process take place in our country come 2017.
President Sirleaf expressed she's not quite sure about what will be the president-elect Donald Trump's trade policy towards Liberia and Africa. And she says she's worried about investment and special programs that have been put in place by, say, President Obama, President George Bush. Are you also concerned about what might happen or might not happen?
Well, we always would be concerned about the nature of the relationship between our country and other world powers, especially the United States of America. But we don't believe that President-elect Trump has had the opportunity to craft a policy towards Africa or specifically towards Liberia. I think he should be given the chance. You know, during the period of the election, a lot of things are said. People appeal to their respective bases. But governing tend to be different because it's not that President-elect Trump or any other elected official of government would act in the interest of a third country like ours, but in their own national security interests. And we think Liberia is quite a partner to the United States, as we've been over the years. And I have no reason to believe that the policies that have been crafted by previous administrations would be shifted or deviated from much.
Charles Bramskins, the presidential candidate of the Liberty Party of Liberia for the 2018 elections. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. The UN Refugee Agency says it is distributing life-saving items to more than 6,000 vulnerable families who are trapped by fighting in South Sudan's Ye River State over the last 6 months. The internally displaced persons welcome the relief aid, but say they should be allowed to return to their villages to harvest crops that they have grown because the food that they are currently receiving is not enough. Tito Justin reports from Juba.
UN state officials say more than 10,000 families were displaced from their homes in Ye River County after fighting broke out between government forces and armed opposition groups aligned to former first vice president Riek Machar. UN agencies say humanitarian conditions were bad because aid workers were unable to access the area due to insecurity. Anna Roba and her seven children are some of the displaced villagers who received food assistance from UN Share this week. Roba's family was displaced 2 months ago from Daystar, an area about 2 kilometers from Ye town. Roba and her children now stay with relatives near the Episcopal Church of Sudan and South Sudan offices in Ye. Speaking in her native Kakwa language, Roba says she welcomes the food aid provided by UN Share, but worries about others still hiding in the bush.
I have a suggestion that if they are distributing these relief items, let's receive them because these items help us with other colleagues to be happy.
Mawa Frederick was displaced from Lopapa village near Ye along with 9 members of his family. He says the food ratios being provided to the IDPs are not enough. He says all he wants is access to his land so he can harvest the crops he has been growing.
We have food which are rotting in the field, whether being cassava, whatever it is, sweet potatoes, gourds, and so on. But the difficulty is how to access to bring home.
Frederick says South Sudan leaders should restore peace so he can return to his village where he can lead a normal life without the sound of guns.
We need peace in our country so that we can also build our country, not always going to neighbors as if we are orphans, depending on uncles to brought us up. Like now, our children are going to get education outside. And meanwhile, we have even better services in the country. Mm-hmm. So my message is that let our leaders sit down and resolve the issue and bring peace to our country.
UNICEF is distributing blankets, sleeping mats, mosquito nets, and soaps to IDPs. Richard Ruati is UNHCR's Assistant External Relations Officer for South Sudan. He is calling on the warring parties in Ye to cease hostilities to ensure a stable environment for humanitarian actors to reach vulnerable people in remote villages.
So we are all appealing to the government and the armed groups who are operating in some of the areas we are supposed to deliver services in. So to give corridor to humanitarian actors and the displaced persons to move freely.
Aid workers and local leaders say thousands of Yei residents were forced to flee to the neighboring Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo because of the rampant insecurity. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
A Kenyan official says the country may not be able to meet its self-imposed deadline of November 30th to close the huge Dadaab refugee camp. Tens of thousands of Somalis have left the camp in recent months, but as Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, they are finding it impossible to scratch out a living back in Somalia.
The Kenyan government announced in May it will soon shut down the Dadaab refugee camp, home to more than 300,000 refugees, mainly from Somalia. Since then, tens of thousands of camp residents have gone back to Somalia, lured in part by promises they will be cared for by UN aid agencies and Somali authorities. But Monday, Reuters news agency quoted a Kenyan Interior Ministry official as saying the November 30th deadline for closing the Dadaab will not be met, because Somalia cannot provide basic services to the returnees. The ministry has not issued an official statement, and the spokesman declined to comment when contacted by VOA Tuesday. But it has become clear that Somalis returning home are facing dire humanitarian conditions, including a lack of shelter, clean water, healthcare and food. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, more than 34,000 refugees have gone back to Somalia, with most settling in the port city of Kismayo. The vice chairman of the Refugees and IDP Agency in Somalia's Jubaland region, Mohamed Noor, says there are no essential social services in place to cater for the returnees. Noor says the returnees had a good life, good health services, and their children were in school getting an education in Dadaab. But when they got to Kismayo, there was nothing for them. So his agency decided to stop receiving people temporarily. Jubaland authorities have refused to accept more returnees from Dadaab for the time being, saying they could not cope with the number of returnees. Amnesty International's Deputy Director for Africa, Michelle Kagari, says Kenya's government is coercing refugees to return to Somalia, where they risk being injured or killed in the chronic conflict.
What we found was that the conditions pertaining in Dadaab with regards to the statements that are being made, the failure to provide any alternative other than going back to Somalia. We also reviewed surveys that had been done by UNHCR and Kenya and also MSF, both of which found that a vast majority of Somalis in Dadaab did not want to return. So on that front, we found that these returns can in no way be seen as voluntary.
Kismayo's Deputy Mayor Abdi Ibrahim Abdi Bare agrees. He says there is nothing to show the returnees have received assistance. He says those repatriated from Dadaab were released to fend for themselves with a stipend that is not enough to live on and are back looking for support. Some observers fear some of the returnees, mostly children and young men, may be forced to join Al-Shabaab. Kagari says some returnees face threats and persecution for failing to cooperate with militants.
There were two boys in particular whose father was killed in front of them. They were forcefully recruited into Al-Shabaab. They managed to escape after 4 months and then made their way back into Kenya. Now they are being required to go back again. Anyone who is returned to Somalia will likely face persecution.
The UNHCR and humanitarian agencies come under pressure to suspend the repatriation process until the situation in Somalia improves. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
That's it for this Wednesday, November 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Bott in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day. Some things change, some remain the same. From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC, GMT, right here on VOA Africa.